monumental sense of honor. During the quarter of a century of Russell's dominance in the Senate Armed Services Committee, he regarded his responsibility to America's fighting men as a sacred trust. He never leaked confidential information to journalists, and members of his committee, even the most publicity-hungry of them, were aware of what his attitude would be if they did. Once, after a closed committee hearing, Wayne Morse of Oregon, looking for headlines, leaked a piece of secret military information. Cornered for a comment by journalists the next day, Russell said he would give one not on the information but on the leak. The comment was a single word, dishonorable. He shared the information Johnson gave him about the Cuban Missile Crisis with no one, waiting for the time when he could discuss it with the president. During a break in one of the meetings in the cabinet room that day, Kennedy inadvertently left the tape running, and it captured a private remark Johnson made to McNamara, not about the missile crisis, but rather about the plane he had leased. "I have a Grumman Gulfstream that I've leased. I want you to lease it from MATS, the Military Air Transport Service. After the election," he said, apparently asking for the Defense Department to pick up the cost of the plane. And he wanted better communications equipment installed on it. "I wonder if there's any good reason why you shouldn't go to somebody and put better equipment on the plane," he said. McNamara appears to have had other things on his mind. "Oh, sure, sure," he said to Johnson, brushing him off. Campaigning in the West, Johnson was away from Washington during what Sorensen calls the first week's blur of the crucial meetings at which the basic decision was hammered out. Early in that week, the tone of XCOM's discussions changed, and the catalyst for the change was Robert Kennedy. At some point, when the general opinion was still for a surprise bombing attack to be delivered the following Sunday, and much of XCOM was pressing the president to authorize it, Bobby passed a note to his brother. "I now know how Tojo felt when he was planning Pearl Harbor." Reminding the group in what Sorensen was later to describe as rather impassioned tones that the Japanese sneak attack on Pearl Harbor, the day that will live in infamy, had occurred on a Sunday, Bobby said that the contemplated Sunday airstrike on Cuba would be a Pearl Harbor in reverse, and it would blacken the United States in the pages of history. And it wasn't just the Pearl Harbor comparison that bothered him, Bobby was to recall. "I could not accept the idea that the United States would rain bombs on Cuba, killing thousands and thousands of civilians in a surprise attack. Maybe the alternatives were not very palatable, but I simply did not see how we could accept that course of action for our country." Every time opinion around the table seemed to be hardening behind the airstrike, he spoke against it. "For 175 years we have not been that kind of a country," he said. "A sneak attack is not in our traditions." While he wanted steps that would make clear America's determination to get the missiles out of Cuba, he felt the Russians must be allowed room for maneuver, an avenue along which to pull back without losing face. The one-time rabid anti-communist was viewing the Cuban problem not just in military but in moral terms. Listening to Robert Kennedy analyzing all sides of the situation, with his emphasis on the moral rather than the military, "We spent more time on this moral question during the first 5 days than on any single matter," he was to say. Undersecretary of State George Ball was very much surprised. He had always felt that Bobby's ideas were much too simplistic and categorical. Either you condemn something utterly or you accept it enthusiastically. And there seemed no intermediate positions. But now, he behaved quite differently. And, Treasury Secretary Douglas Dillon was to say, Bobby spoke with an intense and quiet passion that swayed XCOM. "As he spoke, I felt that I was at a real turning point in history. After listening to him, I knew then that we should not undertake a strike without warning. It was Bobby Kennedy's good sense, his good sense and his moral character, which were perhaps decisive in XCOM's debates," said the State Department's U. Alexis Johnson. Dean Acheson felt differently. He was to say with contempt that Robert Kennedy had been moved by emotional or intuitive responses more than by the trained lawyer's analysis. The president had not sat in on all XCOM's meetings. He wanted to stay away from some of them, his brother would explain, because he didn't want the discussions to be inhibited. Personalities change when the president is present. But he was kept apprised. Returning from a campaign trip to Connecticut on Wednesday evening, the president found his brother and Sorensen waiting for him at the airport, sitting in his car to avoid reporters' attention. "I have the most vivid memory of the smiling campaigner alighting from his plane, waving casually to onlookers at the airport, and then instantly casting off that pose and taking up the burdens of crisis as he entered his car," Sorensen was to recall. But Johnson was not present as the tone in the group, prodded constantly by the president for new ideas, probed by him to make sure that no one was merely trying to guess his own views and agree with them, swung slowly away from the Joint Chiefs' insistence on immediate bombings and possibly invasion, and toward an intermediate step, a naval blockade or quarantine of Soviet ships heading for Cuba with new equipment. A blockade would not necessarily lead to bloodshed, and it would be coupled with a demand that Khrushchev remove the missiles already in Cuba, and with attempts, despite the Soviet premier's deceit in previous dealings, to find some basis for negotiations with him. And the possibility of gradual military escalation would be kept open. Preparations for airstrikes of varying size and for an invasion later if necessary would go forward. On Saturday, October 20th, XCOM decided on that recommendation, and Robert Kennedy called his brother, who was campaigning in Chicago, and the president, pleading a cold, came home. Bobby, sitting on the edge of the White House pool while the president was swimming to ease the pain in his back, gave him the recommendation, and the president accepted it. Lyndon Johnson was also summoned back on Saturday, but since he was on his way to Hawaii, he did not arrive in Washington until Sunday, October 21st. That evening, he was briefed at the Elms by CIA Director John McCone. Although McCone laid out for Johnson in considerable detail the thinking that had gone into Kennedy's decision, the vice president did not agree with it, according to a memorandum for the file that McCone wrote the next day. A blockade, Johnson said, would be locking the barn after the horse was gone, since missiles were already in Cuba. He was also not in favor of gradual escalation, which he called telegraphing our punch. Instead, he wanted an unannounced airstrike, bombing Cuba without warning. The scale of the strike he was advocating is not made clear in McCone's memo. He finally agreed reluctantly with the blockade plan, but only after learning, among other things, the support indicated by General Eisenhower, McCone wrote. Johnson's attitude can be partly explained by the fact that he had not been sitting in on the deliberations of the intervening days, when the pros and cons of the various options had been explored. And, of course, he was not the only member of XCOM. General Maxwell Taylor, McCone, and Dillon were among the others, who were urging in one form or another a harder line. But during the next 5 days, on the first of which Kennedy went on television to tell America that communist nuclear missile sites were being built in Cuba, that Russian bombers capable of carrying nuclear weapons were being assembled just 90 miles from America's shores, that he was immediately instituting a quarantine under which all ships of any kind bound for Cuba would be halted, boarded, searched, and, if found to contain offensive weapons, be turned back, and that if the offensive buildup continued, further action will be justified, I have directed the armed forces to prepare for any eventuality. Johnson was part of XCOM's deliberations. There were moments when he was on the side of caution, once when XCOM was mulling the utility of nighttime photography of the sites, which would require the use of flares. He said, "I've been afraid of those damned flares ever since they mentioned them. Imagine some crazy Russian captain doing it. The damn thing, the flare, goes bluey and lights up the skies. He might just pull a trigger. Looks like we're playing 4th of July over there or something. I'm scared of that." But in general, Johnson's attitude didn't change. These were days of terrible moments. Every day the photos, enlarged, placed on easels in the cabinet room and interpreted by CIA experts, showed that construction of the missile sites was not being halted but speeded up. "That is one launch pad there. The conduiting goes back through this blast wall here. Here are the cables that come out of the control bunker. This is the other launch pad over here, and here is where we think is probably one of the nuclear storage bunkers." Work on the launch pads by thousands of Russian technicians and soldiers was going on day and night now. Some of them would become operational in a matter of days. And when they were, if America had not attacked before then, if America had waited too long to attack, then if America did attack, the missiles with nuclear warheads could be launched against American cities in retaliation. Once nuclear warheads were in place and pointed at the United States, the balance of power in the Cold War would have changed. The Russian ships kept coming. A quarantine line, the line at which armed American sailors would board Cuban-bound vessels, just the type of action that could lead to escalation and then to war, had been established 500 miles off Cuba, and on Wednesday, October 24th, two Russian ships were within a few miles of the line. And just after XCOM convened at 10 that morning came the news that a Russian submarine had moved into position to protect them. An American aircraft carrier, the Essex, with helicopters carrying anti-submarine depth charges, had been ordered into the vicinity. "It's a very dangerous situation," McNamara said in that hushed cabinet room. "We'll declare radio silence, and therefore neither we nor the Soviets will know where our Navy ships are for much of today." This was the moment which we hoped would never come, Robert Kennedy was to recall. In that moment, Bobby saw only his brother. His hand went up to his face and covered his mouth. He opened and closed his fist. His eyes were tense, almost gray. We stared at each other across the table. Was the world on the brink of a Holocaust, and had we done something wrong? For a few fleeting seconds, it was almost as though no one else was there, and Jack was just his brother again, not the president. Inexplicably, I thought of when he was ill and almost died, when we learned that our oldest brother had been killed, of personal times of strain and hurt. The voices droned on, but I didn't seem to hear anything. I felt we were on the edge of a precipice with no way off. 1,000 miles away in the vast expanse of the Atlantic Ocean, the final decisions were going to be made in the next few minutes. Then a messenger came into the room and handed a note to John McCone, and McCone announced that the Russian ships had stopped and might be starting to turn around. "The meeting droned on," Robert Kennedy said. "For a moment the world had stood still, and now it was going around again." The danger was far from over. Some Russian ships, further from the quarantine line, were still continuing toward it at full speed. And even if no more missiles arrived, the ones already in Cuba were still there, and the work on them was continuing. But the constant in all these moments was the determination of the two brothers to give Khrushchev every chance to reconsider, to pull back, the determination to avoid war, and above all, to avoid it through miscalculation. The president had read Barbara Tuchman's The Guns of August, and sitting in the Oval Office after the XCOM meetings with his brother, Sorensen, and O'Donnell, he talked, Robert Kennedy recalls, about the miscalculations that had exploded into the First World War. "They somehow seemed to tumble into war," he said, "through stupidity, individual idiosyncrasies, misunderstandings, and personal complexes of inferiority and grandeur." "The great danger and risk in all of this," he said, "is a miscalculation, a mistake in judgment." He was determined to do anything possible to avoid one. That Wednesday, not long after the tension had been eased, it was ratcheted up again, in minutes of confusion over whether all of the Russian ships had stopped, or all but one, the Kamovsk, which might be turning back or was simply moving in a circle, as if it still might challenge the blockade. There were American planes overhead, the Soviet sub was there, and the Essex. It was just the type of situation in which someone out in the Atlantic might make a mistake. And the time for the mistake was right now, McNamara said. It was 10:40 a.m., almost the moment at which an American destroyer was scheduled to hail the Kamovsk and demand that it halt and submit to a search. "Check first," Kennedy ordered. "We ought to maybe wait an hour on the Kamovsk to see whether... It seems to me you want to give that specific ship a chance to turn around. You don't want to have word going out from Moscow, turn around, and suddenly we sink a ship. Tell the Essex to wait an hour and see whether that ship continues on its course," he ordered. And in fact, the Kamovsk was turning around. By Thursday, 16 of the 25 Russian ships heading for Cuba had stopped dead in the water or reversed course. The next day, Thursday, one of the 9 other Russian ships, the Bucharest, was still steaming toward the quarantine line. Because it was a tanker, it almost certainly didn't carry any missiles or other armament. But, as Robert Kennedy recalls, there were those on the executive committee who felt strongly that the Bucharest should be stopped and boarded so that Khrushchev would make no mistake of our will or interest. John Kennedy assured them that the Navy would stop and board one of the ships. Just not this one at the moment, he said. He would make a decision by nightfall, he said. But that evening, after further heated discussion, Kennedy made a final decision to let the Bucharest proceed to Havana. Against the advice of many of his advisers and of the military, he had decided to give Khrushchev more time. "We don't want to push him into a precipitous action. Give him time to consider. I don't want to push him into a corner from which he cannot escape." Over and over again, Kennedy delayed a decision to take a step that would require force and might be met by force, and therefore might escalate into the war that would destroy mankind. Over and over again, he tried to give Khrushchev more time to think, until on Friday night, the cable clattered over the State Department teletype, a long rambling message from Nikita Khrushchev. It contained an offer to trade. In return for America's pledge not to invade Cuba, the missiles and the Russian technicians and soldiers would be withdrawn. And it contained also very personal sentences about the Russian premier's own fears that mankind was on the edge of the abyss of nuclear war, as well as a statement. "Mr. President, we and you ought not now to pull on the ends of the rope in which you have tied the knots of war, because the more the two of us pull, the tighter this knot will be tied." That message, for the first time, Robert Kennedy said, gave his brother hope that he was not the only one of the two leaders who was trying to pull mankind back from the abyss. During these 5 days, from Monday, October 22nd through Friday, October 26th, Lyndon Johnson was in the cabinet room hour after hour as XCOM met, but he hardly spoke, at least while the group was sitting around the cabinet table with the president presiding. According to Robert Kennedy and Ted Sorensen, he would, however, speak after the meeting was over and the president had left the cabinet room, having switched off the tape recorder. Frequently, after the meetings were finished, he would circulate and whine and complain about our being weak, but he never made any suggestions or recommendations, Robert Kennedy would say. He was displeased with what we were doing, although he never made clear what he would do. He said he had the feeling that we were being too weak and that we should be stronger. He didn't speak even at one meeting at which he might particularly have been expected to. On the Monday of that week, just before his telecast, President Kennedy met in the cabinet room with 20 congressional leaders, hastily ferried back to Washington by Air Force planes from all over the country, to inform them of the decision he had made and of the reasons behind it, and he had Johnson attend the meeting. 19 of the leaders were learning the scope of the Russian buildup for the first time. Richard Russell, of course, was not, thanks to Johnson. He had had a week to think about what should be done, and he did not accept Kennedy's reasoning, although in the week since Johnson had leaked his information, electronic launching systems had been installed at the missile sites. When now Kennedy revealed this, Russell said, "They'd be ready to fire now? My God!" "Mr. President," he said, "I could not stay silent under these circumstances and live with myself. I think that our responsibilities to our people demand stronger steps than that. We're at the crossroads. We're either a first-class power or we're not. The United States should invade and invade immediately," he said. "It would not be an invasion without warning. You have warned these people time and again. They can't say they're not on notice. You have told them not to do this thing. They've done it, and I think you should assemble as speedily as possible an adequate force and clean out that situation." Why had the president been waiting so long to act if he knew work on the missile sites was going forward? Russell demanded. "Why didn't you start when you first got these notifications of all these missiles down there? It's been over 7 days. I think we can die by attrition here. Our authority and the world's authority will hinge on this decision." Foreign Relations Chairman agreed with Armed Services Chairman. "I think a blockade is the worst of the alternatives, because if you're confronted with a Russian ship, you are actually confronting Russia," J. William Fulbright told the president. "What are you in favor of, Bill?" Kennedy asked him. I'm in favor of an invasion, and an all-out one, and as quickly as possible, Fulbright replied. Every congressional leader who spoke at the meeting agreed with Russell. This was indeed the war party, and it included the leaders, perhaps all the leaders, of Capitol Hill. Kennedy was jolted. Later, Robert Kennedy would write that his brother's meeting with the congressman had been the most difficult meeting. It was a tremendous strain. And during it, he had received no help from Lyndon Johnson. Kennedy may have expected that his vice president would help. The men in the room were his longtime allies. Moreover, the vice president had been a part of the XCOM deliberations. He knew and could explain in terms they understood the arguments that would temper their opposition. The meeting had lasted for an hour, and during it, Lyndon Johnson had not said a word. Given a chance to help the president, he hadn't used it. During those 5 days, furthermore, Jack Kennedy's insistence that XCOM explore each option, think through the consequences of each course of action, had won most of the committee members over to his side. And while some, the most hawkish, still felt his response was too weak, the attitude of most of them had been softened. But Johnson was one member of XCOM the president hadn't won over at all, whose attitude had not softened at all, as became apparent on the 6th day after the vice president's return from Hawaii, the 12th and climactic day of the Cuban Missile Crisis, Saturday, October 27th. Hardly had XCOM convened in the cabinet room just after 10 a.m. that Saturday when, as Theodore Sorensen puts it, our hopes, raised by Khrushchev's letter, quickly faded. The Soviet premier had sent a new letter, this time a public message, raising the ante. A no-invasion pledge was no longer all he was asking for in exchange for removing his missiles. The new letter also demanded the removal of American Jupiter missiles based in Turkey. Since the Jupiters were, in fact, all but obsolete, the United States had been considering their removal for some time before the crisis, assuring Turkey that Polaris nuclear submarines in the Mediterranean offered far more protection, not pursuing the matter because of Turkey's strenuous objections. And Khrushchev's proposals immediately appealed to Kennedy. But because Khrushchev had made the demand publicly, America's agreement to it would appear to our allies, as one of them, British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan was to put it, as a sign of weakness, of appeasement. A sign that Khrushchev had, by putting missiles in Cuba, forced the United States to withdraw weapons from an ally. Accepting Khrushchev's deal would appear to demonstrate that to remove a threat to itself, America had sacrificed an ally. Anything like this deal would do great injury to NATO, Macmillan said. All credibility in the American protection of Europe would have gone. That second letter began what Robert Kennedy was to call the most difficult 24 hours of the missile crisis. All that day the news got steadily worse. To add to the feeling of foreboding and doom, Secretary McNamara reported increased evidence that the Russians in Cuba were now working day and night, intensifying their efforts on the missile sites. There were indications that some missiles were being moved into ready position for firing. The Russian Ilyushin 28 bombers, the bombers capable of carrying nuclear warheads, were being uncrated and assembled. Time had all but run out for America, and 9 ships were still steaming across the Atlantic. One of them, the Grozny, was less than 100 miles from the quarantine line and heading straight for it. McNamara said the Navy was readying destroyers to board it. Joining the meeting, the Joint Chiefs delivered their recommendation, an airstrike on Monday followed by an invasion. The President kept postponing his decision. Leaving the cabinet room, he and his brother would walk down the hall to the Oval Office to talk privately there, occasionally calling in Sorensen. Still hopeful that Khrushchev, despite his second letter, might be searching for a way out of the crisis, they were trying to find a way to help him do so, and finally they felt they had. That the president simply ignore the second letter, including the demand about the Jupiters in Turkey, and reply to the first, accepting the deal it had offered. To withdraw the missiles in exchange for a no-invasion pledge. Returning to the cabinet room, he left Sorensen drafting the reply. And then, in the evening, as Sorensen was still working, came news of an American U-2 spy plane that had been photographing the missile installations. Momentarily rattled when he heard it, the president said, "A U-2 was shot down? Well now, this is much of an escalation by them, isn't it? How do we explain? That must be..." Days earlier, XCOM had decided on the actions to be taken if a U-2 was shot down. Immediate retaliation upon the most likely SAM, surface-to-air missile, site involved, coupled with an announcement that if another U-2 was hit, "We'll take out every SAM site." And now a U-2 had been shot down. Its pilot was lying dead in the wreckage, and from all along the long table came angry demands that that decision be carried out. "They've fired the first shot. We should retaliate against the SAM sites and announce that if any other planes, it's what we agreed to 2 days ago." "It looked good then, and it still looks good to me." "Carried out immediately." "You can go against one SAM site, can't you?" McGeorge Bundy said. "Now? Tonight?" The Hawks, dreaming of a Monday morning war, rallied behind the hard line, Arthur Schlesinger writes. And it wasn't only Hawks who were following that line now. "I think tomorrow morning we ought to go in and take out that SAM site and send our surveillance in with proper protection immediately following it. Shoot up that SAM site and send in," Robert McNamara said. There was, in Robert Kennedy's words, almost unanimous agreement that we had to attack early the next morning. "The noose was tightening on all of us," he says. But again his brother pulled everyone back. The letter to Khrushchev was almost completed. It might work. "It isn't the first step that concerns me, but both sides escalating to the fourth and fifth step. And we don't go to the sixth because there is no one around to do so," the president said. He left the cabinet room with his brother to see how Sorensen was coming with the letter, and when he returned about 10 minutes later, leaving his brother and Sorensen working on the draft, he changed the subject. "Gentlemen, come up and sit here now. Gentlemen, let's talk a little more about the Turks, how we're going to handle that. NATO and the Turks, that's the one matter we haven't settled today." Discussions went on about the Jupiter trade, about how to get Turkey and NATO to agree to it. During most of that Saturday, Lyndon Johnson had, as usual, little to say, but that evening President Kennedy and his brother had left the cabinet room, and suddenly the vice president was talking, harshly criticizing what the president was trying to do. "If America agreed to trade the Turkish missiles for the Cuban missiles," he said, "radio and TV reports will give the impression that we're having to retreat." And he said, "Those reports would not be wrong. We're backing down. In fact," he said, "I think we've been backing down gradually from the president's speech." Re-entering the room at that moment, Robert Kennedy heard Johnson's remarks. "Who feels we're backing down?" he demanded. "We've got a blockade and we're doing this and that and the Russian ships are coming through," Johnson replied. "No, the ships aren't coming through," Kennedy said. "They all turned back. 90% of them. They haven't been running for 24 hours. I don't think we can justify at this moment the argument that it looks like we are as strong as we were the day of the president's announcement," Johnson replied. Bobby left to rejoin his brother in the Oval Office, and Bundy started trying to explain that the Navy was still waiting for up-to-date information on the Grozny's position, how close it was to the quarantine line, but Johnson returned to the subject of the president's speech of October 22nd, in which Kennedy had promised further action if the missiles were not removed. The public was going to start asking why the president had not carried out that pledge, Johnson said. Since then, why we... I don't say... unclear. I don't say it's a lie, I just say that's what happens, with public opinion, when it's 101 degrees. Hot. And I think they would see this whole thing, they see the U-2 shot down, and they say, what's your response? For the first time during the crisis, Johnson was doing a lot of talking. And he was talking, the Texas twang authoritative, insistent, overriding other voices, with a fervor that held the table and shifted the mood of at least some of the men around it. With both Kennedys out of the room, he was running the meeting. "Did we get off this letter of points?" to Khrushchev. "Is that finally put in, Mr. Secretary? Well, then, to summarize it, the situation, What has been done today? Let's just see how he, Khrushchev, is looking at our performance today before he shot down this plane. When Rusk tried to answer his questions, Johnson interrupted him. The concept of the trade, removing the Jupiters from Turkey if Russia removed its missiles from Cuba, had a great drawback, Johnson said. The trade would leave Russian bombers and troops still in Cuba. To get them out, he said, the United States would be forced to trade again, to agree to remove our bombers from Turkey. The Jupiters might be obsolete, but the planes weren't, and having them based close to Russian borders was a vital strategic advantage for the United States, and our troops as well. I guess what he's, Khrushchev, really saying, I'm going to dismantle the foreign policy of the United States for the last 15 years in order for the United States to get those missiles out of Cuba. Then we say we're glad and we appreciate it, and we want to discuss it with you. And even more important, Johnson said, accepting a trade showed weakness. Look, the weakness of the whole thing is you say, well, they, the Russians, shot down one plane and they, the Americans, gave up Turkey. Then they shot down another and they, the Americans, gave up Berlin. You know, like a mad dog. He tastes a little blood. Showing weakness to a mad dog was always a mistake, Lyndon Johnson said. He's, Khrushchev, got to get a little blood. And now, by shooting down the U-2, he's got it. And America was still not responding. Now, when they realize that they shot down one of our pilots, we're letting this ship go through and that ship go through. What was needed was strength, action. The American people were going to demand action, he said. I think you're going to have a big problem right here internally in a few more hours in this country. An American plane had been shot down, and the president was taking no action. This ought to start the wires coming in now from all over the country, the states of the Union. Where have you been? What are you doing? The president made a fine speech. What else have you done? They see that there's some ships coming through. There's a great feeling of insecurity. Earlier that evening, Johnson had appeared to be endorsing the trade, but that had been before he understood the terms Khrushchev was proposing. He was pounding home the idea that the time for negotiation, at least for negotiation alone, was over, that immediate military action was needed, rallying the Hawks. In the midst of an exchange with two of them, Treasury Secretary Dillon and former Ambassador to Russia Llewellyn Thompson, he demanded, "You just ask yourself what made the greatest impression on you today, whether it was his, Khrushchev's, letter last night, or whether it was his letter this morning, or whether it was that U-2 boy going down." "The U-2 boy," Dillon replied. "That's exactly right. That's what did it," Johnson said. "And that, attacking a SAM site, is what's going to make an impression on him, Khrushchev. Not all these signals, letters, that each one of us write. He is an expert on that palaver." Johnson was making an argument with the force, so long held in check, that carried all before it. And by the time President Kennedy returned to the cabinet room about 7:20, the effect he had had on the Hawks was obvious. Bundy told the president that there's a very substantial difference between us, and Dillon and Thompson made that clear. Dillon said, "It would probably be more effective and make more of an impression on him if we did do what we said we were going to do before and just go in and knock out this one SAM site. Don't say anything, just do it." "They've upped the price and they've upped the action," Thompson said, "and I think we have to bring them back by upping our action." And Johnson, for once, engaged Kennedy in an exchange, which showed how substantial a difference there was between him and the president. When Kennedy tried to explain that escalation, such as knocking out a SAM site, might well end in invasion, and "we can't very well invade Cuba with all this toil and blood it's going to be, when we could have gotten them, the Soviet missiles, out by making a deal on the same missiles in Turkey," Johnson interrupted him. "It doesn't mean just missiles," he said. "To get the Russian bombers and troops out of Cuba as well, another trade would be necessary. And if America took its planes and troops out of Turkey, why then your whole foreign policy is gone. You take everything out of Turkey, 20,000 men, all your technicians and all your planes and all your missiles, and crumble." "How else are we going to get those missiles out of there, Cuba, then?" Kennedy said. That's the problem. He was still playing for time, time that could bring peace, not war. He wanted to see if his letter to Khrushchev, which he had had his brother hand deliver to Ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin, had any effect, and in the meantime he wasn't taking any action. Everyone should get a bite to eat, he said, and reconvene at 9 o'clock. Then we'll see what we can do about the plane, he said, and discuss this Turkish thing. As the 15 members of XCOM were filing out of the cabinet room to go to dinner, a quiet word was said to 8 of them. Robert Kennedy, of course, Sorensen, Bundy, Rusk, McNamara, Ball, Gilpatrick, and Thompson, to join the president in the Oval Office for another more private discussion. This smaller group included hawks as well as doves. Thompson, Gilpatrick, and Bundy were, to varying degrees, in the first category. But it did not include the vice president. Lyndon Johnson was not invited to that meeting, Sorensen says. Whether it was the harsh words he had spoken to the Kennedys that evening, if you do the Turkish trade, you crumble, he had told the president. We're backing down, he had said to Robert. Or his complaints during the entire week about our being weak. Or his silence when the president had needed his help with the congressional leaders. Or the fear that he could not be trusted not to leak confidential information. Or the unalloyed hawkishness he had displayed from the first day of the crisis through that very evening toward the mad dog in the Kremlin. Whatever the reasons, he had his dinner downstairs in the White House mess. The subject of the discussion in the Oval Office upstairs was what Robert Kennedy should say to Dobrynin, who was probably waiting for him already at the Justice Department. One part of the oral message we discussed was simple, stern, and simply decided, Bundy was to recall. It was the same message sent in the president's letter to Khrushchev. Remove the missiles, and there would be no invasion. Otherwise, further American action was unavoidable. But now Dean Rusk proposed a second, very secret part. That Bobby should tell Dobrynin that while there could be no public deal over the Turkish missiles, the president was determined to get them out and would do so once the Cuban crisis was resolved. The moment Rusk made his suggestion, it became apparent to all of us that we should agree. And they did, Bundy says. And they agreed on something else. The 9 men in that room swore themselves to secrecy. All were aware, as Bundy later put it, that if word of the missile trade, a bargain struck under pressure at the apparent expense of the Turks, leaked out, it might undermine the Atlantic alliance, and that the potential political cost of appearing to appease the Kremlin would also be high. Aware as we also were from the day's discussion that for some, even in our closest councils, a unilateral private assurance might appear to betray an ally, we agreed without hesitation that no one not in the room was to be informed of this additional message, Bundy was to write. The deal remained secret for years. The most important decision of the Kennedy administration was made without Lyndon Johnson's knowledge. At his meeting with Dobrynin, Robert Kennedy told the Soviet ambassador that a letter had just been sent to Khrushchev repeating the offer of a no-invasion pledge if all offensive weapons were removed from Cuba. I said that those missile bases had to go, and they had to go right away. We had to have a commitment by at least tomorrow. He should understand that if he did not remove those bases, that we would remove them. His country might take retaliatory action, but he should understand that before this was over, while there might be dead Americans, there would also be dead Russians. Then Kennedy said, not in writing but only orally, so there would be nothing on the record, that while there could be no direct quid pro quo for the Jupiters, if some time elapsed, I mentioned 4 or 5 months, I was sure that these matters could be resolved satisfactorily. Dobrynin did nothing to commit his country, and Robert returned to the White House about 8:40 p.m. to give his brother, who was having dinner with Dave Powers, a report so pessimistic that Powers, listening to it, says, "I thought it was my last meal." When XCOM reconvened about 9 o'clock that Saturday evening, the two brothers were a little late, and during the few minutes before they arrived, there were more strong words from Lyndon Johnson about how to handle the Russians. And listening to him, Sorensen suddenly felt chilled. It wasn't just the bellicosity of the words, but the force behind them. Lyndon Johnson could persuade men, and without the countervailing presence of the brothers, he might, Sorensen saw, be persuading these. The Hawks were rising, he recalls. Bobby wasn't there, and I was rather concerned about that. The president wasn't there, so I didn't have my strongest allies there. Johnson slapped the table. All I know is that when I was a boy in Texas, and you were walking along the road when a rattlesnake reared up ready to strike, the only thing to do was to take a stick and chop its head off. There was a little chill in the room after that statement. There were strong words also from other Hawks, those after the president and Bobby had entered the room, for there had still been no American retaliation for the death of an American pilot. Russian ships had been allowed through the quarantine line, and others, notably the Grozny, would reach the line Sunday morning, and the missile sites were about to become operational. "Do anything about the SAM site that shot down our plane?" Dillon demanded. Temporizing, the president said the guilty site had not yet been definitively identified. "We don't know which one yet, Doug," he said. McNamara said, "If our planes are fired on tomorrow, we ought to fire back." Kennedy wanted to delay even that, to give negotiations more time and hope that the messages delivered to Dobrynin might work. "Let me say I think we ought to wait until tomorrow afternoon to see whether we get any answers. We're rapidly approaching a real..." "Wait until tomorrow," he said. "If tomorrow they fire at us and we don't have any answer from the Russians, then Monday, it seems to me, would be time enough. And then go in and take all the SAM sites out. The fate of mankind might hang in the balance. Surely the chance for peace could be given one more day." "I think we ought to keep tomorrow clean," Jack Kennedy said. There was still the Grozny. It was going to reach the quarantine line at about 8:15 or 8:30 Sunday morning. This time it was the younger brother who spoke, in a low, very soft voice. "It's just a question of whether we want to intercept that at all tomorrow, or let it go through. Whether this ship gets in or not, it's not really going to count in the big picture. Isn't it possible to decide tomorrow?" "Yes, we can wait until about noon tomorrow," McNamara said. And finally, Jack Kennedy decided. "Give them that last chance," he said. And peace had one more day. There was little optimism that that extra day would bring peace. Saturday night was almost the blackest of all, Schlesinger was to recall. Unless Khrushchev came through in a few hours, the meeting of the executive committee on Sunday night might well face the most terrible decisions. Strategic Air Command bombers were circling endlessly over the Arctic that night. The crews of other bombers were being handed their target packets for bombing runs they might have to make the next day. American destroyers were circling in the Atlantic, with, a few fathoms below them, enemy submarines. The 5th Marine Expeditionary Brigade began boarding ships to invasion staging areas. Watching the sunset that Saturday night, McNamara wondered if he would live out the week. But the next morning, a golden autumn Sunday morning, the Grozny suddenly came to a dead stop, and the 9 o'clock newscasts were interrupted by a bulletin. Khrushchev had accepted Kennedy's terms, the no missiles, no invasion terms to which the president had brought him back by ignoring the second letter. The letter ended with this salutation to John Fitzgerald Kennedy: "With respect for you, Khrushchev." XCOM met that Sunday at 11. When the president walked into the room, everyone stood up, standing silently until he sat down. As he began the meeting, there wasn't, Ted Sorensen recalls, a trace of excitement or even exultation in his bearing. It had been no oversight that Lyndon Johnson wasn't invited to that crucial conference in the Oval Office on Saturday evening. On Sunday, after the final XCOM meeting, Jack Kennedy said to his brother that this was the night he should go to the theater, like Lincoln after the Union victory in the Civil War. And Robert, the subject of assassination having been raised, and with it, of course, the reminder that the vice president would thereupon become president, said that if he was going to the theater, I would go too, having witnessed the inability of Johnson to make any contribution of any kind during all the conversations. In later years, he would recall Johnson's displeasure with what we were doing, the way, in Bobby's words, that he would circulate and whine and complain about our being weak, while never making any suggestions or recommendations himself. The people who had participated in all these discussions, Robert Kennedy was to say, were bright and energetic people. We had perhaps amongst the most able in the country. And if any one of half a dozen of them were president, the world would have been very likely plunged into catastrophic war. Lyndon Johnson, he would make clear, was one of that half dozen. Jack Kennedy, as always, was more oblique, but through the means of another shorter list, he also made his feelings clear. Recalls his friend, the journalist Bartlett. He said after the Cuban Missile Crisis that there were three men on that executive committee that he would be glad to see become president of the United States: McNamara, Dillon, and his brother Bobby. He said that a couple of times. Three men whom John F. Kennedy would be happy to have succeed him as president. The vice president wasn't one of them. "You must know as well or better than I President Kennedy's steadily diminishing opinion of him," Jacqueline Kennedy would, years after the assassination, write in a private letter to Ted Sorensen. As his term progressed, he grew more and more concerned about what would happen if LBJ ever became president. He was truly frightened at the prospect. Early in December, Lyndon Johnson received a note from Robert Kennedy saying that he, together with some of the other executive committee members, was buying a Christmas present for the president in remembrance of our days together during the Cuban Missile Crisis. "We are not yet certain of the cost, but when that small matter is worked out, I will write you a letter asking for a voluntary contribution," Kennedy said. While Johnson had not been one of the XCOM members who had planned the gift, a sterling silver plaque showing the month of October, with the 13 days of the crisis in bold numerals, the note at least implied that he would be invited to the presentation. "Mac Bundy will be in touch with you about the arrangements," it said. When, however, on December 17th, Bundy's secretary called one of Johnson's secretaries, Winnie Coates, to inform her that the presentation would be the next morning at 8:15, the call was not exactly an invitation. She said Mr. Bundy felt it would not be necessary for everybody to be there at such an ungodly hour, Winnie reported. Johnson got the idea. He didn't attend. But when he was asked for the contribution, "The happy, joyful ceremony must now be paid for," Robert Kennedy wrote him. "I would greatly appreciate it, therefore, if you would send me a check for $200, which will cover your assessment." He sent the check right off. After the Cuban Missile Crisis, Evelyn Lincoln was to write, Mr. Kennedy seemed to be less concerned with making sure the vice president was occupied, and from then on he let Mr. Johnson seek his own place in the administration. Johnson's response was the technique he had always used with people who had more power than he, as Mrs. Lincoln observed with barely concealed contempt. The vice president became more apprehensive and anxious to please. He tried even harder to enter into activities and become part of them. Whenever anyone mentioned Mr. Kennedy's name, he would immediately tell them what a good job he was doing. He praised the efficiency of the Kennedy staff and the soundness of the Kennedy ideas. Time and again, as they filed out of the cabinet room, I would hear Mr. Johnson making these glowing compliments. Elbowing his way through a group standing in her office after one meeting, he came up to the president. He stuck out his hand and said, "That was a fine speech, Jack." But he wasn't dealing with elderly senators now. Fawn over Jack Kennedy, though he might, Mrs. Lincoln says, the president was sending him fewer memos and giving him fewer assignments, and as a result, Johnson was fading into the background. In 1963, one saw much less of him around the White House than in 1961 or 1962, Arthur Schlesinger was to write, and this wasn't a mistaken impression. In 1961, according to Mrs. Lincoln's detailed diaries of the president's activities, Johnson had spent only 10 hours and 19 minutes alone with the president, a meager enough figure. In 1962, the figure had been smaller. In 1963, the vice president was alone with the president for a total of 1 hour and 53 minutes. And Kennedy's attitude was reflected in the attitude of his staff. "I hate to admit it, but in planning the surprise birthday party for Mr. Kennedy on May 29th, I forgot all about inviting Mr. Johnson," Mrs. Lincoln says. "And no one reminded me." The president was still, of course, dispatching him on foreign trips and assigning him routine ceremonial duties. The vice presidency is filled with trips around the world, chauffeurs, men saluting, people clapping, chairmanships of councils. But in the end, it is nothing, Lyndon Johnson was to say years later. I detested every minute of it. And when he tried to make something more of the foreign trips, steps were taken to make sure he couldn't. During his September 1963 visit to Finland, recalls America's ambassador to that country, Carl Rowan, there was an earthquake in Iran, and he, Johnson, wanted to go there to demonstrate American caring. The White House said no. It said no as well to the very possibility of another trip. In a casual conversation in the embassy in Helsinki one evening, Johnson, boasting about his ability to read men, said, in Rowan's recollection, that he could look into the eyes of the Soviet leaders and see what was in their hearts. This statement was relayed to Washington, which evidently became concerned that the vice president might try to visit Finland's neighbor, Russia. I got a secret back channel message saying, do what you must under any circumstances to prevent Johnson from going to the Soviet Union, Rowan recalls. And as Schlesinger was to write, the psychological cost was evidently mounting. Historian and secretary used the same phrase. He seemed to have faded astonishingly into the background, he says. People who remembered him, tall and lean and bursting with energy, emanating power and authority as he strode through Capitol corridors and commanded the Senate chamber from his front row center desk, were shocked when they saw him now. His complexion was gray, and on that canvas face, now so gaunt, was painted sadness. Sitting at meetings in the cabinet room, gray, withdrawn and silent, he appeared, in Schlesinger's phrase, almost a spectral presence. When some official did telephone him, he seemed unable to stop talking, until the official, the brief purpose of the call accomplished, became desperate to get off the phone. Social occasions could be poignant. Invited to a fundraiser at the Fifth Avenue apartment of a wealthy New York couple, like a fool, I went, he told Harry McPherson. The president was there, sitting in a big easy chair, and everyone was in a circle around him, leaning in to hear every word. I was leaning over, too, and suddenly I didn't want to do that, to be leaning over listening to Jack Kennedy. Walking over to the French doors, he stood there alone, staring out over Central Park until the hostess noticed, and asked a group of young guests, will somebody go and talk to the vice president? A beautiful young heiress, Jean Murray Vanderbilt, said, I'll talk to him, but what can I talk to him about? The hostess, who knew Johnson, told Vanderbilt, don't give it a thought. And Vanderbilt was to say, she was right. He never stopped talking, and he was so charming. After they had talked for some time, Johnson offered her a ride home, and as he let her out of the car, he said, I'll never forget how nice you were to me tonight. And of course, with the blood in the water so plainly visible now, the journalistic swarm was more avid than ever. It would be a rich treasure for historians if there were a tape recording of the talk Jack Kennedy gave to Johnson in the Biltmore Hotel in Los Angeles to persuade him to accept the nomination. Few men in American history have given up so much for so little, the Miami Herald said. By the end of the year, the boast he had once made was being used to taunt him. In an article in the Reporter magazine under the now familiar headline, Whatever Happened to Lyndon Johnson, journalist Ward Just wrote that once, Johnson had said, power is where power goes. It has not worked out quite that way, as LBJ would probably admit. The man of power who suddenly finds himself short of it is a fascinating study. Lyndon Johnson seems determined to shun controversy. With newsmen, he is strictly for background only. The result is that LBJ has all but disappeared from official sight. The relationship between Kennedy and Johnson is one of the most curious in Washington. Is there, in fact, any business relationship at all? Said a Time article in January 1963. Power is where power goes, Johnson confidently told a friend before taking office as vice president. He was wrong. Power has slipped from his grasp. All of the jobs he had been given, the chairmanships of the Space Council and the CEEO, the membership on the National Security Council, all of this together adds up to only a fraction of his old power and influence. He is free to speak up, but nobody really has to heed him anymore. The popular television show Candid Camera asked random passers-by, "Who is Lyndon B. Johnson?" Not one knew. One of those questioned said he couldn't be expected to know. "I'm from New Jersey." "Well," said another, "he's not president. Am I getting close?" And in 1963, also, his predicament was growing worse due to another factor. Over Jack Kennedy's dealings with his vice president, there was painted, even if only lightly and only in public, a tint of respect and of the wry amusement that made the president call him Riverboat. Now Lyndon Johnson found himself increasingly dealing with, increasingly in confrontation with, the president's brother. The hatred that Lyndon Johnson felt for Robert Kennedy on that terrible afternoon in Los Angeles had never faded. It would never fade. He would talk about that afternoon for the rest of his life. Years later, back on his ranch after his presidency, not long before he died, he would seize visitors' lapels and bend his face into theirs in the intensity of his effort to make sure the visitor understood that it hadn't been Jack Kennedy, but Bobby who had wanted him to withdraw from the vice presidential nomination. Recording his thoughts to guide the ghostwriters of his autobiography, he made sure they understood. "He came to my room 3 times to try to get me to say I wouldn't run." Time was curing nothing between the two men. The traditional seating arrangement for cabinet meetings, established in the chronological order of the creation of the different departments, placed the Attorney General next to the Vice President. Saying he didn't like that arrangement, Bobby had his place moved. With no formal seating arrangement at National Security Council meetings, sometimes the two men found themselves sitting side by side. And as Richard Goodwin, seated against the wall behind the president, noticed, they literally couldn't look at each other. And as Johnson knew, or thought he knew, or said he knew, who had been responsible for his humiliation in Los Angeles, he knew, or thought he knew, or said he knew, who was responsible for all the humiliations of the following 3 years. "Jack Kennedy's just as thoughtful and considerate of me as he can be," he told Bobby Baker. "But I know his snot-nosed brother's after my ass." Such statements were made with a conviction that persuaded assistants and allies that Johnson believed what he was saying to be true. But the more perceptive of them wondered if the remarks were yet another example of him believing what he wanted to believe. In this case, what he felt he had to believe. Feeling as he did that the fulfillment of his dream, of his life, depended on his staying on as friendly terms as possible with the president, anger at Jack Kennedy wasn't an option. And therefore, as Doris Kearns Goodwin was to write, Johnson projected his feelings onto Bobby. During her conversations with Johnson at the ranch, she says, it was Bobby he reserved his anger for. It was Bobby who was cutting him off the list of invitees at the White House. If he had submerged feelings towards Jack, and they had to be there, then Bobby becomes the target of those feelings. He blamed him for the ill treatment. He couldn't afford to blame Jack Kennedy, although clearly Bobby wasn't acting in any way his brother would disapprove of. Everything was Bobby's fault. He couldn't be rational where Bobby was concerned, Bobby Baker says. Says Ashton Ganella, he thought he was sneaky. He thought he lied. I can't say the rest. He just hated him. There was an additional ironic note. In explaining to his angry allies why he had accepted the vice presidential nomination, Johnson had said, in a phrase he used repeatedly, that if he couldn't be the number one man in Washington, he would at least be the number two man. Now, however, Life magazine's issue profiling Bobby bore the headline, "The Number Two Man in Washington," and U.S. News and World Reports said, "Robert Kennedy, Number Two Man in Washington," and Times said simply, "Number Two," each headline another dash of salt in Lyndon Johnson's wounds. And Johnson had read at least one aspect of Bobby Kennedy well enough to know the feelings were mutual. "When this fellow looks at me, he looks at me like he's going to look a hole right through me, like I'm a spy or something," he told John Connolly. But to a man whose life is based on calculations of power, the crucial factor in any equation is who possesses it. And Lyndon Johnson's eyes, so keen at these calculations, knew the answer. By the beginning of 1963, all Washington understood that Robert Kennedy had transformed the Justice Department, turning it into a newly aggressive foe of organized crime and juvenile delinquency, and that his role in government had been expanded far beyond his department, that following the Bay of Pigs debacle, his brother had assigned him foreign policy responsibilities as well, had in fact brought him into the inner circles in which foreign policy is decided. But Johnson saw more than that. He saw the signs that, to the skilled calculator of power, meant more than the assignments. Who entered a meeting beside the president, which meant that the president had been consulting with him before the formal deliberations began. Who the president quietly asked to stay behind after the meeting. Whose views at the meeting were embodied in the presidential decision that followed. "Every time they have a conference, don't kid anybody about who is the top advisor," Johnson blurted out one day. "It isn't McNamara, the chiefs of staff, or anybody else like that. Bobby is first in, last out. And Bobby is the boy he listens to." Nor was it merely a matter of advice. Bobby was more than an advisor. He was a brother in a family in which the blood tie meant all. The Attorney General was unfailingly formal during meetings, never forgetting that he was addressing Mr. President. But sometimes on the way out in a brief huddle together, the names the Attorney General and the President still called each other in private slipped out. Johnny, Bobby. It was the way that they sometimes communicated without words. The reaction of one brother to the other's statement being conveyed in a shrug of the shoulder or a shake of the head. It was the way that, as Arthur Schlesinger wrote, "they always talked in the cryptic half-sentences that bespoke perfect understanding. The way they finished each other's sentences. Watching them at a formal state dinner where they were sitting far apart, a guest was struck by how each heard through the chatter what the other was saying and chimed in on it. They hardly had to speak with each other, the guest said. They understood each other from a half word. There was a kind of constant, almost telepathic contact between them." Asked once to explain, Jack Kennedy said, "It's by osmosis." Lyndon Johnson heard and saw it all. He sued for peace. The suit was pursued first through a subordinate. John Sigenthaler, the aide perhaps closest to Robert Kennedy, received a telephone call from Walter Jenkins. "We have to work together," Jenkins said. "We have to keep these two fellows from embarrassing themselves by publicly feuding." The call, Sigenthaler says, was basically to say no hard feelings about anything in the past. And Jenkins made clear that his principal was willing to go more than halfway to effect a rapprochement. Mentioning some matter that the vice president wanted to discuss with the attorney general, that was merely an excuse to make the call, it was clear. Jenkins said Johnson would come to the attorney general's office at any time that was convenient for him. "Well, what time would you prefer?" Sigenthaler asked. "No," Jenkins said. "What's convenient for you?" Sigenthaler said he was sure a mutually convenient time could be worked out, but such an arrangement would be contrary to the instructions Jenkins had been given, and he said, this time with agitation in his voice, "No, no, it's got to be convenient for the Attorney General. Would you check with the Attorney General?" And when, although the appointment was granted and Johnson made his visit to the Justice Department, the situation did not improve, he pressed the suit in a more informal setting. An upstairs kitchen at the White House, where, after a dinner dance in January 1963, guests were scrambling eggs for an after-midnight snack. Approaching the Attorney General, Johnson said, "I don't understand you, Bobby. Your father likes me, your brother likes me, but you don't like me. Now why? Why don't you like me?" Bobby, in the recollection of Charles Spaulding, one of the other guests in the kitchen, agreed to the accuracy of all this. But Johnson wouldn't let it drop. "Why?" he kept asking. "Why don't you like me?" He was begging, crowding against Bobby, and Bobby kept retreating and letting him beg. It was a role Bobby was enjoying. The discussion was completely in his favor and in his hand, Spaulding says. And although Johnson asked the questions again and again, it seemed to Spaulding that this went on and on for hours. "Why don't you like me? I don't understand it. Now why?" Bobby wouldn't answer them. Finally, Johnson said, "I know why you don't like me." The reason was a misconception, he said. The press had misquoted statements he made at the 1960 convention. "You think I attacked your father," he said, "but I never said that. Those reports were all false. I never did attack your father, and I wouldn't, and I always liked you and admired you. But you're angry with me, and you've always been upset with me." That explanation, though, didn't have the desired effect at all. A day or so later, Kennedy repeated Johnson's explanation to Siegenthaler, who, as a reporter for the Nashville Tennessean, had in fact been present in 1960 at Johnson's speech to the Washington State delegation, in which he had called Joseph Kennedy a Chamberlain umbrella man, and said, "I never thought Hitler was right." Kennedy asked Siegenthaler, "Do you remember what he said?" "Yes, I do," Siegenthaler said, and repeated Johnson's words. When Kennedy told Siegenthaler of Johnson's claim that his remarks had been misquoted, Siegenthaler said, "Well, he's not telling the truth." Looking up microfilms of the articles on Johnson's attack that had run in the New York Times and other newspapers, he sent reproductions to Kennedy with a note, "There can't be much doubt that he was vicious." Kennedy told him dryly the next time they met, "If the press misquoted him, it's a general misquoting." Among the aspects of Robert Kennedy's character most conspicuous to his intimates was what Life magazine called his genuine contempt for liars. "He could forgive anything in a staffer except lying," one aide says, "if you tried to fool him." The only result of the encounter in the White House kitchen was a reinforcing of his convictions about Lyndon Johnson. "My experience with him since the convention," he was to say, "he lies all the time. I'm telling you, he just lies continually about everything. He lies even when he doesn't have to lie." Not that his convictions needed reinforcing. Bobby Kennedy's behavior during the Cuban Missile Crisis had not been the first indication that behind the Torquemada glower, the prosecutor's jabbing fist, the bullying, the insistence that all surrenders be unconditional that made the adjective ruthless an apt description no matter how deeply he resented it, beneath the idolization of his father, the need to attain his approbation, which seemed to be the constant motivation in his life, that beneath all this there was something more, something quite different within Robert Francis Kennedy. Hints of it had appeared long before the Cuban crisis, before he had become Attorney General, in fact, even before he had been Joe McCarthy's assistant, before he had even entered government. His father was an anti-Semite. No matter how biographers may try to gloss over that trait, it was there. Jews were the problem with the movie industry, Joe Kennedy had found when he first went out to Hollywood. A bunch of ignorant Jewish furriers had taken it over, simply because they had unethically pushed their way into a wide-open virgin field. Jews were a problem in government, too. There is a great undercurrent of dissatisfaction with the appointment of so many Jews in high places in Washington, Joe wrote his friend, the British press czar Lord Beaverbrook, in 1942. Behind Joe's tolerance of Hitler, a biographer notes, was a willingness to write off the Jews, as well as almost anyone else, to achieve peace. But when Bobby himself, still the religious teenager, the most devoutly Catholic of Rose's children, encountered anti-Semitism, he could not contain himself, even though the sentiment came clad in priestly robes. Listening to the fascist diatribes of the anti-Semite Father Feeney on Boston Common, something made Bobby burst out, interrupting the priest to tell him that what he was saying contradicted the Catholic principles he was being taught in school. "I was horrified," Rose said. "My own son arguing with a priest. But when the Vatican excommunicated Father Feeney, I knew Bobby had been right." After Bobby's graduation with C's and D's from Harvard in March 1948, his father arranged for him to tour the Middle East, and arranged also for him to be accredited as a correspondent for the Boston Post. Crossing the Atlantic on the Queen Mary, he dined, at his father's insistence, with Beaverbrook, who explained to him that the United States was a subjugated nation to a Jewish minority. But when he arrived in the Middle East and saw, with his own eyes, Jews fighting for their existence against overwhelming odds, and was told by a 23-year-old Israeli woman, "I never saw anyone so tired," he wrote his mother, about her four brothers fighting in the Haganah, the views he expressed in his articles for the Post were not the views of his father. "The Jews in Palestine have become an immensely proud and determined people, a truly great modern example of the birth of a nation," he wrote. They have an undying spirit the Arabs could never have. As for the United States, its failure to come more strongly to Israel's assistance should be a matter of shame. We are certainly not the good little saints we imagine ourselves. And there was another noteworthy aspect to the articles, written as they were by such a mediocre student.